Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the days hills over a beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and, well, we'll wait and see if we're going to have calls. If we ask for them, we do hope you'll call us at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Dr. Thomas E. Woods, Jr., and he's written a fascinating book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. Dr. Wood, thank you so much for being with us again this evening.
Dr. Stan, a pleasure.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about it yourself? I know about you because I've read the back of the book, and I know you have a PhD from Columbia University, and you've actually worked as a professor in education in the past. But what caused you to write a book about the politically incorrect history? I mean, are you suggesting that what we're taught in high school and college, a lot of it just isn't accurate?
I think I'm going well beyond that.
I'm a victim of a liberal education, so I understand what you're talking about, but please explain to our listeners.
Well, as am I. I mean, I'm a product of the public schools, too, but, you know, it goes to show that your education doesn't stop there. You're really only just getting started. And what I'm suggesting is that really the narrative of American history that we get all too often in high school and college is, you know, it's a lot of propaganda in a lot of cases. It's propaganda on behalf of big government and on behalf of centralized government and against, well, basically the Jeffersonian principles of local self-government, the free market, the Constitution. The way the story is told is to make us denigrate the latter things and to make us want to celebrate the expansion of power of Washington, D.C., and portray that as a progressive, wonderful development, when in fact it's been no such thing.
In fact, it's just the antithesis of what our founding fathers wanted or feared, isn't it?
What we have now is so exactly the opposite of what the founding fathers intended that there aren't words in the English language to describe how much the opposite it is.
Well, you make a point that our founding fathers, the people who created this country, who participated in the Revolution and wrote our Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and Bill of Rights, they really weren't conservatives at all, were they?
Well, I mean, in some ways they were, in some ways they weren't. I mean, in some ways they weren't, in that certainly by emphasizing the idea of government based on the consent of the people, that was a radically new position. That they were taking John Locke's view. Government is based on the consent of the governed. It's not based on divine right. It's not based on any such thing. So that's very radical. At the same time, though, they were conservative in the best sense of the word, in that when they drafted the Constitution, they drafted it remembering the experience they'd had under Great Britain. When they lived under, as colonists, American colonists, they lived under the British Constitution. And that British Constitution was not a written document. It was a collection of tradition and customary practice. So it was very hard to pin the thing down. If the British government said, hey, this is constitutional, and the colonists said, no, it isn't, it's a terrible oppression, it's hard to pin the thing down because it's not a written document. So what the colonists consistently said was, we want to live according to tradition, the way we've always lived. That's what the British Constitution is. And the British came back and said, you'll do what we say you'll do, and that's why we have a written constitution, to make sure that doesn't happen again, that we can pin down the government and say, this is what you can do, this is what you can't. That's very important.
And of course, really, the British tradition was based upon the Magna Carta, the British Bill of Rights, Petition of Rights. There were all these things, but they were never laid out point by point like the American Constitution. We'll be back here in just a moment with Professor Thomas Woods and talking about American politically incorrect. Well, of course, you've actually outlined very well the fact that our founding fathers really feared government, and they wanted to limit the power of government, which is certainly the antithesis of what we see today. Wouldn't that be a fair statement?
Absolutely, yes.
All right. So how did we get from where we started to where we are today? In other words, why do we have a government and people in Washington, D.C., who seem to want to regulate every aspect of what we do, whether it's medicines, the vitamins we take, want to regulate, you know, what we do with our property, want to be able to control the rivers, want to be able to control the air, want to be able to control literally everything about us?
Well, when you think about it, any time people can get something without having to pay for it, they tend to want more of that thing. If I can get lawn chairs or potato chips without having to pay for it, I tend to want and demand more of those things. Well, the same thing goes for government regulation. Politicians don't have to pay the costs associated with more and more regulation on business. It's no problem to them, no skin off their backs, no problem for them. So naturally, we get more and more and more of it because the people who are imposing it don't bear the burden. So they tend to demand more and more of it. We get interest groups who want to see these types of regulations, but they don't have to pay the costs of them. It doesn't cost them a thing. So there's a natural tendency built into the system to have more and more and more regulation. But beyond that, the question is, you know, how do they get away with it, though? Why don't people rise up in righteous indignation against it, against the expansion of government, against the taking away of people's rights to govern themselves at the local level? Why don't they resist? Part of it is they don't know what's happened. A lot of Americans, especially I know from teaching in the classroom, when I tell them what the states, you know, were intended to be able to do and local government was intended to be able to do, and whereas today they've got almost no powers, the federal government dictates to all these units, people are shocked and surprised and want to know why this has been kept from them and why don't we resurrect these old principles. So I think a lot of this, as quaint and trite as it sounds, is a matter of re-educating people about the truth of their history.
And, of course, I'm old enough to remember when every county had a county hospital and the local government was responsible for taking care of the health care of the indigent. And then the government, federal government, came in and said, oh, we're going to take care of everybody, don't you worry. And they put in Medicare and Medicaid and created a safety net. And now, of course, what they've done is driven the cost of medical care up so high that many people in the middle class really can't afford it, and now we have people really going without health care, whereas this never happened before the federal government got involved in the problem.
That's right. I mean, all you have to do is read, just get old newspapers. I mean, look up old newspapers in the 1950s and early 60s. You're not reading articles about people dropping dead.
Hold that thought right there, please.
Pardon me?
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we just have our stations coming back on board. Our guest this evening is Professor Thomas Woods. We're talking about his book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. And one of the points he makes is that the Puritans didn't steal the Indian lands. We often hear how terrible the Puritans were and how they exploited the Indians and took their land away from them. And, of course, everything is done to denigrate the founding fathers of this country, the people who came here to settle in the wilderness and build the great country that we have today. So do you want to address that point about really how the Puritans were able to negotiate with the Indians for their land, and did they take it from them in force, or did they trade them for goods?
Right. Well, it's a good question, and it's an important one. And I answer it by first noting that certainly nobody would deny that the Indians did suffer great injustices at various times in American history. There's no question about that. But what I'm saying is that in early American history, particularly with the most reviled group of American settlers, I would say with the most reviled group by historians today would be the Puritans who settled 17th century New England. Historians today tend not to like them, or at least, you know, people who write textbooks tend not to like them, because their theology is different and stern and not in line with modern liberal theology and whatever. And so they tend to get the worst treatment you can imagine in textbooks. So, of course, they're viewed as just preying upon the Indians and being vicious and this and that. But interestingly, scholars who actually concentrate in this field, who write books on this subject, are more and more actually saying, wait a minute, the Puritans' record was not spotless, but at the same time, by 17th century standards, it was really quite good. That in fact, it is in no way accurate to say that the Puritans just stole the Indians' land. To the contrary, in many cases, the Indians invited the Puritans in to live near them. Like, for instance, in the Connecticut Valley region, the Indians were positively enticing the Puritans to live there, partly to be a counterbalance to the Pequot tribe, whom everyone feared and hated. So the Indians, in fact, invited the Puritans in very often, and the fact is that they were a Neolithic society. I mean, they were living basically in the European Stone Age. And for them, you know, metal tools and implements were of tremendous value in a society like that. And they've got land in incredible abundance. I mean, remember, all of North America at that time had maybe 1 to 2 million people in the entire continent. So that means they've got much more land than they know what to do with. So in my book, I give the specifics on this. I tell you what books are reliable, where you can get the real information about this. But the idea that the Puritans were just a bunch of genocidal maniacs looking to wipe out all the Indians is about as wrong as wrong can be, basically.
Well, let's talk about another misconception, and that is the real cause of the Civil War. Now, everybody knows the Civil War was fought over slavery to free the slaves. Is that the true cause, or was it a byproduct of the Civil War?
Well, certainly the slave issue is not the cause of the launching of the war, and professional historians will concede that point to you, but the point is that people in elementary school, when they get out of elementary school, I mean, that's what they've been taught, is that the war was fought to free the slaves. I mean, I would venture to suggest that the vast majority of high school and even college graduates have that idea, that Lincoln just woke up one day and said, all right, that's it, this is a moral abomination, we're going to war with these people. But, that couldn't be more wrong. In fact, that's the type of history that is written in order to sanctify rather than to enlighten. It's to sanctify government decisions. Lincoln wanted to save the Union. He wanted to keep the southern states from seceding. And once this war to prevent that secession was over, you've got 1.5 million people either dead, wounded, or missing, property destruction you can't believe, people starving, you've got the Constitution being trampled on for years. Of course, with this kind of devastation, you need to come up with some sugary rationale. Oh, it was all to free the slaves, so as to make it seem as if the damage isn't so bad. But it wasn't to free the slaves. That was an after-the-fact rationalization 18 months into the war. The fact is, Lincoln actually said to the South that he would support an amendment to the Constitution that would forever prevent the federal government from ever abolishing slavery in the future if that's what it would take to keep the South from leaving the Union. I mean, he was quite clear about this. If he interfered with slavery, it would only be because he thought by doing so he could save the Union. The fact is that Lincoln believed that if he did free the slaves, they could not be assimilated into American society and would have to be deported somewhere else in the world. He was obsessed with that idea throughout his entire presidency. So this is something like the opposite of the saccharine, sugar-coated version of Lincoln that you tend to get in elementary school. But a free people cannot afford to engage in hero worship. We can admire people in our history, but we cannot make idols out of them.
Well, I think it was George Santayana who said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
That's right.
And I really believe that we need to look at the Civil War, and it's my understanding that the Emancipation Proclamation was not issued when the war began, but well into the war, and it came about after there had been massive anti-draft riots in the North, several thousand people killed because they didn't want to go off and fight in this war, and they had to have a justification for it. So Lincoln freed the slaves in the South, which he couldn't, of course, do because he didn't control them, but he did nothing to free the slaves in the North, which he could have done.
That's right. I mean, there were still states in the Union that had slavery. So Kentucky, for instance, or Delaware had it, even, you know, and Missouri. And so he could have, you're right, he could have, if he'd wanted to, come up with some rationale for freeing those slaves. Instead, his Emancipation Proclamation, as you say, applies only to the states that have seceded. So, of course, they don't believe they're under Lincoln's authority. And it was interesting that several people in the leadership of the British government at the time joked about this and said, isn't it interesting that Lincoln frees the slaves where he has no power to do so and leaves them in bondage where he does have power to do so? How can you possibly take this man seriously?
And tragedy is, this is not taught in our schools today. who controls the flow of information? Who controls the educational system that is teaching our young people stories that have no basis in fact?
Well, I mean, we should bear in mind, this will sound possibly simplistic to some listeners, but I've been through it. I know these history departments, these colleges. The fact is that once the political left gets a foothold in a history department, they tend to replicate themselves. They hire people like themselves. They don't hire people who have radically different points of view. They hire people who have basically the establishment point of view, who admire all the same presidents. And they tend to hire establishment left or even establishment right type people. I mean, there are some conservatives who are very pro-Lincoln. Hillary Clinton's very pro-Lincoln on the left. You know, I mean, there's a consensus out there, and they don't want people who question the consensus. There's a certain sanctified version of American history that you've got to uphold. And if you call any of it into question, if you want to rethink any of it, or you want to tell the story differently, they're really not interested. They're not going to hire you. So that's the situation that we're faced with. So friends of mine who are eminently qualified have to go on the job market with one hand tied behind their backs. They have to conceal articles they've written. They can't mention that they wrote for this or that publication. Whereas if you're a left-wing scholar and you've spent your whole career writing for the Radical History Review, nothing to worry about. You don't have to keep that off your resume. They eat that right up. So unfortunately, there isn't a level playing field out there, and it's the students and the population at large who suffer, because instead of a good, healthy competition of ideas, they get the same boring, stale platitudes, that are based on ignorance.
And I really feel that there is a great deal of ignorance out there, which is why I do what I do 5 hours a day, trying to get people to understand the real history of our nation. And, of course, really, from my point of view, this very real spiritual forces that have brought us to the tragic situation, as well as certainly the historical forces and the political forces and the cultural forces, the spiritual forces as well. Well, one of the points you make in your book is the story of something called Operation Keelhaul. In fact, this is one of the things that really changed my life. It was 1962. I was a graduate of the University of California, minored in history, had all the degrees and the keys and the various honor societies. And I really thought I was pretty smart. There's nobody more dangerous than somebody who's a graduate of college and thinks he's pretty smart. And I heard an old man on television talking about something called Operation Keelhaul and the forced repatriation of millions of Russians to the Soviet Union at the end of the Second World War, and I'd never heard of Operation Keelhaul, and yet you refer to that in your book.
That's right. I think Dr. Sen, not many Americans have heard of Operation Keelhaul, and part of the reason for it is that none of the governments that were involved will open up their archives and let us look at the relevant documents. They're all supposedly matters of national security, even though, you know, the Soviet Union is, Nazi Germany's dead, the Soviet Union's dead, and still we can't be told about this. Well, basically what it boiled down to was, when World War II ended, obviously there are prisoners of war all over the place. Now, Americans and British who had been taken prisoner, naturally they wanted to go back to America and Britain. But Russians who had been taken prisoner typically did not want to be returned to the Soviet Union, partly because some of them, after they had been captured, fought against the Soviet Union. They figured, might as well take this opportunity to rid our country of this crazed maniac, Joseph Stalin, and Stalin was not really interested in distinguishing between which prisoners had taken up arms against him and which hadn't. He was either going to kill them or work them to death in the gulag, and, I mean, some people committed suicide rather than return, but basically Franklin Roosevelt had discussed this with Stalin, and then after he died and the war ended, Harry Truman brought this into effect, whereby at least 1 million Russians were, against their will, forcibly returned to Stalin and certain death. And in fact, as I show in my book, atrocities took place on American soil. At Fort Dix, New Jersey, hundreds of Russian POWs who had been promised they would not be returned were forcibly returned, and when they resisted, they were actually drugged and subdued and put on a ship and sent back to the Soviet Union. That's beyond despicable.
I mean, this is really one of the greatest tragedies in American history. And yet it has been totally suppressed here in America.
Absolutely. There was a BBC, no mention of it at all, that's right.
BBC documentary, great documentary, we have copies of it, not allowed to be shown in America. Why? Because somebody's controlling what the American people think. That's Operation Keelhaul, and, well, maybe we can touch that a little bit more in just a moment or two. Well, Dr. Stan here, our guest this evening, is Thomas E. Woods, Jr., and we've been talking about Operation Keelhaul. It was the forced repatriation of at least a million Russians. Figures that we have come from various sources, a book called The Secret Betrayal by Tolstoy, Nikolai Tolstoy, The East Came West by a gentleman, I've forgotten his name, but certainly Julius Epstein's book, Operation Keelhaul. And there are a number of books written about it, and yet, of course, they're never or almost never discussed. And this is why I was so pleased to find Professor Woods was talking about Operation Keelhaul, because when you are able to suppress and conceal something like this from the American people, it suggests that there is not only control over history, there's control over the entire media here in the United States. How would you respond to that? I mean, why doesn't sometimes the newspapers talk about this?
It's a good question. I mean, part of it, it's interesting that as when you talk about our media, we congratulate ourselves on our free press, but the fact is we have got, really at this point, a completely lapdog press that more or less just repeats propaganda. You pretty much have to read British newspapers or other, you know, foreign newspapers, which now we, thanks to the Internet, we have more and more available if you want to get to the bottom of things a little bit more. I think some of it is that the American media and the educational establishment and all the rest of it, they're so caught up in this cult of the president. The president is like the savior figure of the nation. I mean, there's this cult of personality almost associated with the office, and they want us to look up to him and think of this as the bully pulpit, and the idea that the president could actually have been involved in something not just of a Lewinsky level, but of an absolutely the level of an atrocity. Well, that would shatter people's confidence in the federal government, and these folks have so many great plans for that federal government, they can't afford to shatter people's confidence in it, so they'd rather just not tell us.
I think I've seen over the last 25 years two articles in the Wall Street Journal on the editorial pages about Operation Keelhaul, and that's all. You know, and of course, if you read something day after day after day of the recent Karl Rove controversy, or certainly the Michael Jackson situation, or the O.J. Simpson, you see it day after day after day. It's you focus on it. If you see two articles over a period of over 25 years, who is even going to be concerned about Operation Keelhaul? It can't be very important, even though it involved the death of at least according to what I've read from very reliable sources of close to a million people. So either they were immediately killed, and many of them were, or they were shipped off to the gulag where they were worked to death and intentionally killed there. So, but you see, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose, and the people at the highest levels of our government, in our own military, forcibly put these people onto trains and then onto boats, and actually sent them back at bayonet point to their death. And in fact, this BBC documentary we have, you'll see some of the British officers who were involved actually weeping when they think of what they'd done and how they betrayed everything they believed in simply to follow orders. But that is the tragedy. That is what the military does. So I'm really so glad that Dr. Woods brought out the background of Operation Keelhaul in his book, and of course gives you references where you can get some of the information. And that's why I really think this book is really so very, very valuable. Well, we're going to talk about some of the other things that are covered here, the war on poverty, because, of course, every time the government declares war on terrorism, we get more terrorism, drugs, more drugs. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, Dr. Stan and our guest this evening, Professor Thomas Woods, and we're talking about, we mentioned Operation Keelhaul, and the fact that most Americans have never heard of the forced repatriation of at least a million Russians to the Soviet Union. The figures that I got from the Tolstoy's book, The Secret Betrayal, were much higher than that, but it doesn't matter. It's the principle, the fact that the average American has never heard this. And that there is such a degree of control over the media today and over history that the average American has never heard of Operation Keelhaul. Well, Professor Wood makes a point in his book that we had a war on poverty, but ever since we started the war on poverty, we've had more poverty. Would you like to pick up that idea?
Well, certainly. I mean, there's a reason that the book is called The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, because it basically tries to overturn the conventional wisdom on so many things. And so, you know, when you have something like the war on poverty, well, the impression that people are given is that, well, the government set out to do this, so it must have been successful. Or it had good intentions, or war on poverty, the idea sounds good, and as if we don't need to investigate what the consequences were, or even predict what the consequences might be, which some people tried to do at the time. Well, what I'm showing in the book is that the poverty rate before the war on poverty had been coming down consistently without any government program aimed at abolishing poverty, as if such a thing could be possible. Instead, you had for about 18 years, from about 1950 onward, you had the poverty rate coming down by about a percentage point per year. Then 1968 comes along. It's the end of Lyndon Johnson's term. It's when the money really starts picking up for these war on poverty type programs, and that is precisely when the poverty rate levels off and just stays consistently around 12-13% down to the present day, and it just stays stagnant. And now we've spent between $6 and $7 trillion on the war on poverty. I mean, you could buy all the Fortune 500 companies, buy all the farmland in America with this money, put, you know, both of those things together, you still wouldn't have $6 or $7 trillion. And yet we have, in effect, nothing to show for it other than we've destroyed a lot of communities, we've given incentives for people to have births out of wedlock, because that's the way the program works, or not to have a husband around, or have him around only intermittently, because only then do you keep getting the money. Every social pathology you can think of is indirectly encouraged by these very programs. And so I'm giving chapter and verse in there about example after example. And a small example is the Job Corps. Now, the Job Corps is a job training program. It's supposed to take people from the inner cities, get them out of the cities for a while, train them in some job, and give them the skills they need to be in the workplace. Well, this thing has been a failure for over 30 years. We've spent billions and billions of dollars. It costs about as much to send a child to Harvard for a year as it does to send them to the Job Corps. And yet, what are the results? It turns out that if you go into the Job Corps program and you finished it, you have no better job prospects, it turns out, than somebody who got into the Job Corps and never showed up for the program. I mean, so in other words, it has no effect at all, and yet my students, I've had students say, well, if it's really that bad, how come the government keeps funding it? And I love the naivete of the students. They wonder, if the program doesn't work, why is the government continuing it? Well, every congressman wants to be able to say, hey, I got all this Job Corps money. Like, nobody cares about the results, nobody asks, nobody looks into it. And so the result is that even when Bill Clinton said, we're going to abolish welfare as we know it, at the same time, he was proposing an increase in money allotted to the Job Corps, one of the most demonstrably failed programs of the past 35 years, and it has no sign of disappearing either. So that's a classic example of what we're talking about. It spends enormous amounts of money with absolutely zero to show for it. I mean, nothing. And what happens? It keeps getting more money. I mean, no private business could afford to function like this. It does something that consistently fails. They would never be able to keep pouring money into it. They'd go out of business before long. But the U.S. government, of course, does not go out of business.
And, of course, one of the greatest tragedies of what it's done to the black family, you know, before we had the welfare program, the black family, there was discrimination, certainly. But blacks had their homes. They were husband and wife and children and usually raised in the church. Today, 75% of black children are born out of wedlock, and the black family is totally dysfunctional, and it directly can be attributed to these government programs, and everything they did actually made matters worse for the blacks. But, of course, we were told, oh, this is to help the poor people, it's to help the blacks, to help the poor. And I can remember when I first heard about this, and they said, you know, there are 4 million people who eat beans every evening for dinner. And then, you know, a few months later, it was there 10 million people who go to bed hungry every night. And that's how you justified the war on poverty. And today, look where we are. Well, we'll be back in just a moment with Professor Thomas Woods. And actually, if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We're talking about politically incorrect history. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Professor Thomas Woods, and we're talking about his book, which goes into the background of the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. And one of the things he points out is that a lot of people honestly believe that the First Amendment of the Constitution prohibits prayer in school. How do you approach that? Because certainly everybody knows there's a wall of separation between church and state, and after all, the Supreme Court wouldn't have made this law if it wasn't based upon tradition. Some people, the outvoted people, think this was at one time a Christian nation, but that really wasn't true, and that's why we had to take prayer out of school. Is that correct?
Well, again, I think we've hit an issue where the conventional wisdom that people have been taught is about as close to the opposite of the truth as you can get. And I think a revealing aspect of this is the fact that in the first, say, 150 years of American history, nobody thought the First Amendment prohibited school prayer. I mean, no one who drafted the First Amendment thought that it did. Thomas Jefferson didn't think so, even though he had very unorthodox religious views. He would never have said the federal government can tell every single school system in America what its prayer policy should be. Now, my own personal view is I tend to oppose prayer in the public schools because I oppose people being in the public school. They should try to get into a private school or homeschool, given the state of the public schools these days. But the principle is that, according to the First Amendment, the federal government stays out of religion. It's a non-interventionist policy toward religion. It does not say that the federal government has the power to run around into states and localities and tell them what their policy should be. The First Amendment is not a grant of power. It doesn't say, here, we're empowering the federal government to go make sure nobody's praying. It says to the federal government, we're not empowering you to do anything other than to stay out. And that's why when you look at the First Amendment, it's speaking of Congress. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. It doesn't say anything about Hoboken, New Jersey. That's up to the people of Hoboken to decide how they want to run their school system, and it would have been considered the height of tyranny for one federal judge or the Supreme Court or whatever to tell every single school system in the country how their school should be run. I mean, the Constitution would never have been ratified if they thought for one second that that's what it meant. Whereas now we have this view that the First Amendment authorizes the federal government to make sure that nobody has got a nativity scene in front of the town hall and no one's singing Christmas carols in the school. As I say, no one would have ratified the Constitution if they thought that it meant that. It simply meant the federal government stays out and states and localities make their own judgments
about
matters like
that. Hold that thought right there, please.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Professor Thomas Wood. His book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. And we were just talking about this wall, so-called wall of separation between church and state. And Professor Wood was saying that the First Amendment, if you read it, it says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the pre-exercise thereof. That's what it was. It was a limitation placed on the power of the central government because, although he didn't comment, I'm sure he would agree that at the time our Constitution was founded, many of the states hadn't their own state religion. There were some that were Quaker, and some that were Congregational, some that were Presbyterian, some were Anglican. But there was no question at all that many of the states had state religions, and the whole idea was to keep the federal government out of religion completely. So how did we get from where we were when America was founded to where we are today?
Well, I mean, the technical answer involves the interpretation of the 14th Amendment, which has been interpreted to give the federal government basically the power to take all the principles of the Bill of Rights and apply them against the states, which is a fancy way of saying that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, ratified shortly after the war between the states, has been used as an entering wedge for the federal government to, in effect, butt its nose into just about every state matter you can imagine. I mean, if you can think back to the 1990s, I remember when in South Carolina, this isn't a church-state matter, but nevertheless, we had the case of the Citadel, which was a military academy in South Carolina, all male, of course, but there was a woman who wanted to enter. And the federal government, under the 14th Amendment, said that she has a right to enter this all-male military academy. Now, no one who drafted the 14th Amendment thought that it meant that someday a state would not be permitted to maintain an all-male military academy. But what happens is, as with the 14th Amendment, as with the Constitution in general, you have some, you know, some open-ended phrases, some ambiguous phrases, or some phrases that later judges can drive a truck through that give the federal government an entering wedge into all the matters involving the states, and they always do this portraying it as an advance for liberty. We're advancing the freedom of people by giving them a chance to enroll in an all-male military academy. That's the type of saccharine language they surround it with, but the fact is that it violates the standard American understanding of self-government, that if South Carolina wants to have an all-male military academy, that's up to the people of South Carolina to decide, and not know-it-alls in Washington, D.C., trying to extend unconstitutional power over them.
I agree with you totally, and I think that sometimes there are people in Washington, D.C. who have a different view of the world, who have a different agenda. And we have judges who don't look at the world as the average person does, and they've massively expanded the government control over every aspect of our lives, and in so doing, certainly undermined the very religious foundation upon which this country rests. Well, let's go to Ray, who's calling in from Santa Cruz. Ray, did you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, this is something that's been on my mind for a while, but why is it that we're told in our schools, in our universities, that this country is against communism and against fascism, when in fact we supported the repressive communist regimes in South Africa, and of course we helped the Nazis in World War II with people like Prescott Bush, who became senator. But the whole thing is that we're told all these things, and yet the reality of it is so just the opposite, you know.
All right. Sidney, do you want to comment at all on what Ray is saying there?
I understand the frustration that very often what we're taught is the opposite of the truth. I mean, my thinking on this matter would be that, an even more egregious blunder would be if you say that, that what we've seen is a consistent anti-communist policy on the part of the U.S. government. Well, then how do you explain the almost mind-boggling statements of President Franklin Roosevelt when he's talking about Joseph Stalin? I mean, we had to know was one of the, most monstrous human beings who ever walked the earth.
Right.
And he's saying things like, when Stalin was young, he was briefly in the seminary, and apparently it didn't take. He left.
No.
But Franklin Roosevelt actually said, I think something of his seminary training must have stayed with him because he knows what it means to be a Christian gentleman. I mean, what do you say?
Oh, my God.
But what an obscenity that is. And he made statements like this. I quote them all in my book. How can we account for this? And when it was brought to Roosevelt's attention that Stalin's going to be controlling all of Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. We have aides to Roosevelt who basically tell us that he doesn't seem to have cared. He just doesn't seem to have cared. And he actually said that, and I promise I'm not making this up, that after the war, if I give Stalin everything he asks for without asking for anything in return, then noblesse oblige, he will be obligated to work together with me in the world. I mean, he actually said that. I mean, you'd have to be comatose to say that. I mean, you'd have to be under the influence of some substance to say that. So the best you can do is just try to, write the history correctly.
Yeah,
and
right.
One thing that satisfies me, if I may say, about my politically incorrect guide to American history is that, it actually was a New York Times bestseller, and that's part of the reason it got attacked so much, because all of a sudden, the establishment realized that tens of thousands of people all of a sudden are learning the opposite of what they've been told. And they cannot be allowed to stand. We've got to go after them with character.
Yeah.
Boy, did they ever.
Okay,
Nixon, President Nixon, opened the doors to China, Pandora's box, is an evil empire, But yet he helped, he helped to bring about the situation that we've got today with the Chinese being such a big threat, you know?
Well, the thing, Ray, is you have to understand that nothing is as it appears to be. No Republican, pardon me, no Democrat could have opened the doors to utter communist China because if it was too much of an anti-communist feeling in the United States. The American people back in the period of the late 1960s, early 1970s,
yeah, right.
realized that we were fighting communism or supposedly fighting communism in Vietnam. They realized, of course, that the communists had killed between, 60, 80 million of their own people when they'd taken over. This was a cruel and ruthless regime. No Democrat could have opened the doors to China, but Richard Nixon could do it because he was an anti-communist. If you understand nothing as it appears to be, then everything makes sense.
Then everything makes sense.
Okay. You just keep listening here, Ray.
Oh, okay.
God bless. Okay, and we'll get to Roger in just a moment or two. I just want to get to another couple of things that Professor Woods has talked about here. How hundreds of American liberals had secret ties to the Soviet Union. Now, that sounds like McCarthyism.
Right, I know, and so therefore it must be wrong, according to a lot of people. Well, it turns out, and you would think that this should have been front page headline news in the 1990s, but it turns out that over the past, say, 10, 15 years, we've learned an awful lot of very revealing information about the state of Soviet espionage penetration into the U.S. government in the first half of the 20th century, in the 30s and 40s in particular, because of the Venona decrypts, these transcripts of that American intelligence managed to get of Soviet communications around 1943. There was a security vulnerability in Soviet transmissions. Briefly, there was this brief window in the early 40s, and so American code breakers were able to decode, or at least begin the process of decoding a lot of Soviet messages. And we've now learned, as of the 1990s, what was in those messages. We've now learned the names of at least 350 Americans who were, in fact, actively, who were in the U.S. government, who were actively working for the Soviet Union. And since we've only decoded about 10% of these, there's still a lot to go. The number must be higher, but we can say with certainty right now that it's at least 350 people. That is a very substantial penetration, and if anything, it shows that McCarthy had underestimated the state of the problem. So you would think in the 1990s when we learned this, that there was serious penetration of the country's mortal enemy during the 40s, and that it basically vindicates what the anti-communists had been saying was going on, you'd think this would be all over the papers. But I know this is going to come as a big surprise, Dr. Stan, but it's absolute silence.
Incredible.
Not a word.
There's a wonderful book that was put out. It's out of print now, but it was called The Verona Files, The Verona Interceptor. And it just catalogs this whole incredible story and even goes into Harry Hopkins, who was living in the White House with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was looked on by the communists as one of their assets. He was the closest advisor to the President of the United States.
That's right. And in fact, I mention that book in my book because one of my aims is to try to tell people what are the sources that you should consult. And even if a book is out of print these days, you can still usually track it down with something like bookfinder.com. You can find a lot of used books that way.
And I think it's so vitally important that for our listeners that they begin trying to get the truth. And certainly Professor Wood's book will give you, point you in the right direction to the books you need to read to hear the story of Operation Keelhaul. To hear the story of the Verona Files, to hear the story of what really happened at Yalta, when the United States turned Eastern Europe and China over to the communists. They knew exactly what they were doing. They just didn't want the American people to know. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Roger, do you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, this is so great. I almost hate to ask my other question. Oh, by the way, would you see any evidence that they're seeing that the code breaking goes along as slow as possible or anything?
I never thought of that, actually. I'd rather not comment simply because I know so little about code breaking. Maybe this is normal. Maybe it normally does take 30 years to decode things. I honestly don't know, but now that you mention it, it does seem a little bit peculiar, doesn't it?
Right. Anything else, Roger?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, would there not be plenty of evidence that those, and tongue-in-cheek, guilt-constricted and sexually and otherwise repressed Puritans that they started out and continue to have been more inclined to regard the American Indians as a mission field, of less inclined to regard them as subhuman, and more reachable for the gospel, and were probably more often jovial and tolerant than the more secularized elements of colonial American society?
All right, good question. Thank you, Roger. And first, then the question would be, have we given the Puritans a pretty bad, they said a lot of things about the Puritans that really weren't true. Didn't the Puritans try to reach the Indians with the gospel?
Right. Certainly they did, and of course today, just the very idea of that is politically incorrect. I mean, you should leave them to enjoy whatever their natural beliefs are, but what's fascinating to me about the Puritans, and I also note this in my book, is just take the example of John Eliot, the 17th century guy. Imagine this. Here's a guy, John Eliot, who wants to spread the gospel to the Algonquins, the Indians he meets. So he learns their language. He learns their spoken language. And then he realizes they don't have a written language. So after learning their spoken language, John Eliot invents a written language for them and then translates the Bible into that written language. I mean, first of all, the intellectual, how intellectually demanding that must have been is almost beyond comprehension. But if you're just going to say the Puritans, you know, they just wanted to oppress the Indians, well, if they just wanted to oppress the Indians, I bet there were easier ways than learning a foreign language from scratch, developing a written language out of it, and then translating the Bible into it. I mean, I think at the very least you have to say that there was sincerity on their part. And then another point that I would make is that the Puritans are often accused of being racist toward the Indians. But this is demonstrably false, because the Puritans didn't believe the Indians were of a different race. They believed the Indians were white, but their skin color had to do with the influence of the sun and, you know, other factors like that had darkened their skins, but they didn't believe they were of a different race. They believed that culturally they were inferior, but they had no racial animosity toward them.
In fact, we can read some of the writings of George Washington, who addressed the tribal chiefs and encouraged them to embrace the Christian religion because it would help them to live happily and to really be better people. So I think many of the founding fathers of America were strong in their Christian beliefs, but this is never brought out by the media today, and our textbooks tell us that our founding fathers were all deists and none of them were Christians.
Right, and I think, to me, even though I'm at this point promoting a book, Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, I still would point out that there is a book that people who are interested in this topic should read. It's called Original Intent by David Barton. And this book is so, just when you thought you knew all about this, the founding fathers and Christian religion and all this stuff, I mean, this guy has done unbelievable research. You are going to win every single argument you get into if you get David Barton's book, Original Intent. It's an absolute smash of a book. I mean, unbelievably important. I mean, go get it immediately before you get my book. Go get this one.
Well, actually, Radio Liberty does carry that book. I agree with you.
Oh, wonderful.
We
good.
Think it is such an important book for people to read to understand our Constitution and what the original intent was of the men who created this great nation we live in. Well, before we go on, because we're drawing towards the end of the program, how can people get copies of your book?
Well, my Politically Incorrect Guide to American History is actually available on Amazon and the usual internet outlets, and it would also be in the American History section of your bookstore. If it isn't, then gripe about it, but it should be there.
All right, fine. Do you have a web page or a telephone number you'd like to get out?
Someday I'll have a web page, but we've just had two little girls born the past couple years, and boy, that cuts into your time in a nice way, but someday I'll have the website, but not now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this idea that the Marshall Plan, that where America gave massive amounts of money to Europe after the Second World War, the Marshall Plan was a great success and brought prosperity to Western Europe. Would you like to address that issue?
I certainly would, because this is a very, very widespread misconception. I mean, it's not just the liberal left that believes it. I read in one of Ann Coulter's books, she just took for granted that the Marshall Plan was a big success. And so it's just taken for granted by everybody. But I give the evidence in the book that, in fact, this is no more successful than any of the other foreign aid programs of the 20th century that have been boondoggles and catastrophes all. And unfortunately, most of them were modeled on the Marshall Plan because everyone assumed it was a big success. They said Western Europe was doing badly, Then the U.S. sent the money, then they were doing well, so the money must have caused the recovery. But that's a logical fallacy. I mean, the two things could be unrelated. There's no necessary connection between them. And as I show in my book, the fact is that the countries that got the most Marshall aid, like Britain, did the worst or lagged behind tremendously countries like Germany or Austria. In fact, Austria only really began its recovery as this Marshall aid was being phased out. So there, again, there's no connection between these things. What seems to have caused the recovery was not that they got some handouts from the U.S. government. It was that these countries, the Britain less than others, got rid of their wartime government controls on the economy. They got rid of their price controls. They instituted a free market as they did in West Germany. West Germany, the result was such a tremendous explosion in wealth that they had to coin a word for it, the Wirtschaftswunder, the economic miracle. So it's free markets and it is not government giveaway programs. And that should be the lesson we should be learning about foreign aid to Africa. They've gotten billions and billions and billions and billions, and all it's done is entrenched bad leadership. They need a dose of reality, and they need to institute the free market.
Somebody once said that foreign aid is taking money from poor people in a rich country to give it to rich people in a poor country.
Well said.
We'll be right back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Professor Thomas Wood. We're talking about his book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. And certainly, he has all sorts of stories to tell, with so many more than we could really get into just in 1 hour. But certainly things we certainly want to touch on. One of them is sort of the story of Landslide Lyndon. This is when Lyndon Johnson, of course, won his vote, his effort to become a senator. And what was the story of there?
Right. Well, this nickname, Landslide Lyndon, a lot of people think he must have gotten it when he defeated Barry Goldwater for president by such a landslide in 1964. But actually, no. The nickname Landslide Lyndon was actually meant in an ironic way, because it involved his Senate race, his first Senate race. And what basically had happened was that it looked as if when the votes came in, that Lyndon Johnson had lost the Senate seat to, I believe, Coke Stevenson. So it looked like he had lost. But then, interestingly, several days later, from the small town of Alice, Texas, came a couple of hundred additional votes, and most of them were for Johnson. And so Johnson ended up winning the election by something like 87 votes. Well, the interesting thing, and so he wins. So, of course, Landslide Lyndon, 87 votes is a drop in the bucket. Well, the interesting thing is that these votes that were suddenly brought forth at the last minute, interestingly, the people who cast these votes all seem to have voted in alphabetical order, which would probably raise some suspicion in people's minds. And it turns out that 4 years after Lyndon Johnson died, the election judge in Alice came forth and admitted that he had helped to rig that election. And, of course, you notice that he waits 4 years after Lyndon Johnson's death just to make sure he's dead and can't enact any reprisals, because Johnson was the type who wouldn't have taken anything like this very kindly. So after he was deceased, then this gentleman came forth and admitted that the thing was rigged.
Well, there was a fellow named Halley who wrote a book called A Texan Looks at Lyndon.
Oh, yes.
It was a very unflattering book. He commented that Lyndon, of course, was not above having his friends eliminated. And he mentioned a number of instances where people had met an early demise because they crossed Lyndon Johnson. But that's not what the liberal media would tell us.
No, it's not. But even though that book, I think, is out of print, A Texan Looks at Lyndon, nevertheless, if you go to something like bookfinder.com on the Internet, you can get that book, I'm not kidding, for about 5 cents. I mean, they've got a million, people have got them in their homes. They don't know how valuable they are. You should get yourself one if anybody's listening.
Well, we're out of time, but I really want to thank you so very much for being with us. I think we have you on one of our other programs, and we'll look forward to that as well.
This is one of the best, most substantive interviews I think I've ever done, Dr. Stan, so thank you very much.
Good. Bye-bye. God bless you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I hope you've enjoyed our guest this evening. I think the issue is so important. is the realization that we're really not getting the truth from the controlled media. And of course, there are many, many sources of information out there that will point out that the media as a whole in the United States is largely controlled. In fact, there's a wonderful book written by a professor at the University of California. He's retired now, but his name was Ben Bagdakian. And his book is entitled The New Media Monopoly. And Professor Bagdakian started analyzing the American media back in 1983, at which time there were about 50 mega corporations, or the major corporations, that dominated the American media. And through a series of editions of his book, and I think it was either the sixth or seventh edition that came out in the year 2004, by that time, five mega corporations dominated the American media: Bertelsmann, Disney, Fox, Viacom, and Time Warner. Five mega corporations determine what most people hear, what most people see on television, what most people read. And because of that, of course, the average American has very little idea of what's going on in the world today, and we certainly believe our people need to get more information about what's going on. Now, we do hope that many of you will seriously consider going to our website at radioliberty.com, where you can listen to our programs on the Internet 5 hours a day. And, of course, then if you have more time, why, many of our programs are archived there. You can be connected, linked to several other networks where our program is heard on the Internet. But the Internet is a wonderful means by which we can reach you. We also are on the shortwave 4 hours a day, and we hope that you'll get those frequencies down and listen yourself and or tell your friends, because we need to educate the American people. Time is short. Freedom is lost when good people do nothing, and the price of liberty is, freedom is eternal vigilance. I would simply quote what Thomas Jefferson said. He said, if a people think that they can live both ignorant and free in a state of civilization, they expect what never was and never will be. If a people think that they can live both ignorant and free in a state of civilization, they expect what never was and never will be. You'll find the quotation in Bartlett's Quotations, but it is true today as when Thomas Jefferson wrote it. And let me also note that one of the things he said was this: God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. But can the liberty of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God? I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice cannot sleep forever. And so I really think that people must understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought for the souls of men. Our job is to make people understand pretty what's going on, that there indeed is a spiritual battle going on behind the scenes. If any of our listeners would like to get a copy of the June Radio Liberty newsletter, why, it's called The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, and it goes into the people who really rule the world from another dimension. And we simply quote from the books written by people who are in contact with that other dimension. A great deal of fascination with a recent NBC program, it could be heard here in the fall, called The Medium, about a woman. It's a real story, at least. There really was a woman who worked with a district attorney in her community to find who the bad guys were. But she tapped into this mysterious force. Now, let me tell you, you do not want to tap into this force because you're tapping into the demonic realm. But there are people who have the ability to do that, and there is another realm. Many of the people, the key people in various governments and positions throughout our society have tapped into that. And if you'd like to know more about it, my newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, you can find it on our website at radioliberty.com, or give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And just ask for a free copy of the June newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy, Part 2. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And we'll be back in just a few minutes for the next hour. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring, and I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. The views of our guests, the views of our callers. Now, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Bob Griswold from Ready Made Resources. And Bob certainly is in the business of providing things that people need in case of an emergency. Now, we live in a very uncertain world. The average individual thinks that the utopian society we live on is going to go on forever. But if you've ever lived in another country, as I have, ever lived in Africa, and you see the abject poverty of the people there, the disease, the violence that exists just beneath the surface, and is always breaking forward into either racial strife or wars or revolutions, and this is going on all throughout the world today. Here in America, why, we live in a truly utopian existence. But I would like to suggest that, first of all, from a geopolitical point of view, we have managed to antagonize the people throughout the Muslim world so that many of them are quite willing to destroy their lives, to blow themselves up just because of an intense hatred of America. And there are other people who would like to bring this country down because they feel that we are arrogant and haughty and we're trying to tell everybody in the world how to live. And there is a very real threat of a nuclear attack on America. When it will come, I don't know, but as I read these scriptures, I see descriptions that would make me think that they're talking about a nuclear attack. There's a very real threat of biological attack. In fact, if you read Revelation 6:8, you will hear and read what they talk about, and I look and behold a pale horse, and the rider upon him was death, and Hades followed shortly thereafter, and power was given unto them to kill a quarter of the population of the world with a sword, with pestilence, which is disease, with famine, and with death, and the beasts of this world. If you go and you read that, and then you look and see what's happening today, and realize that if God is just, he is going to bring judgment on this country. Understand that we, I truly believe, are in very difficult times. And so I asked Bob to come on from time to time just to tell you what he's getting. He's traveling throughout the world, going to the meetings where people in other countries are making preparations to protect their people. We have literally no adequate preparations in this country. Bob Griswold, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Doctor.
Tell us, you just got back from an international meeting, another one?
Well, the last one I went to was a few months ago. I do have business overseas at times where I meet individuals, but sometimes it has to do with my alternate energy. I do a lot of alternate energy, in UK and actually Europe right now, and that's why one of the reasons why solar panels are so difficult to come by is the fact that the European Union is buying them up, and they're really going, full stride ahead in developing alternate forms of energy. In fact, when you fly over the European continent, it's amazing how many of these large wind generators you see. And so that's what I was involved with some work concerning that.
Okay, fine. Then you were, of course, dealing with solar energy and wind energy rather than attending. But I know a few months ago you were over in the Far East, actually attending a meeting there where they were, of course, demonstrating all of their military hardware and of course, the defense hardware for the people. But that was for other countries, not necessarily for America. Countries are preparing to defend their people from what they feel is some very real problems. We're going to be back in just a moment with Bob as we explore what's going on throughout the rest of the world. And then we ask the serious question. If other countries are really worried about their populations and terrible things happening to them, why are they worried here in America? Well, Bob, why don't you just briefly mention, where was that meeting? Was that in Thailand or Malaysia, Singapore?
Singapore.
Singapore, okay.
Doctor, all anybody has to do is go online and look and see the arms industry. And when I say arms industry, not only defensive, offensive arms, but defensive arms, defensive type of munitions like protective masks, protective suits, decontamination equipment, detection equipment. The armies of the world, and I don't know how much they're providing for the people, but the armies of the world, they're really expecting this. A lot of technology is going into developing better gas masks, better protective equipment. Because I think everyone knows that as our scientific ability increases, it becomes easier and easier for people to develop weapons of mass destruction, biological, chemical, and even nuclear. It just becomes very easy. Centrifuge technology, how they separate the uranium that makes enriched uranium, is becoming more and more readily available to people. And you can actually take some, low-level radioactive waste, and if they can do, they do it correctly. I was watching a scientist explain that they can actually extract and make high-level radiation, radioactive material out of it. That's stuff you can make a bomb out of. And that's just becoming easier to access for the average person. I read a website, a credible website a while ago that said the reason, we don't capture bin Laden, and I don't know if this is true or not, I'm just throwing it out, Doctor, is the fact that he has suitcase nuclear weapons in our country, and that if we capture him, he's using those to blackmail us so that we don't go after him, because he'll detonate one. That could not be true. But the fact is that the ability to obtain radioactive material is widely known to be very easy if you have money. The Soviet Union lost control of quite a bit of their nuclear material. Even in the United States, we hear from time to time they've misplaced something, they've lost our laboratories where we have the scientific knowledge to make nuclear weapons. Stuff is gone, hard drives are missing. And this is stuff that's happened over the last decade. And now we're hearing a renewed thing that nuclear weapon is a real possibility. I've been reading some things that say that, that they're expecting it.
Well, it's very interesting. We have a very good friend named Craig Roberts, Colonel Craig Roberts. I've retired from the military, but he has a lot of contacts still within the military and intelligence, and he really believes. In fact, I had a email from him today that sometime this year, somewhere in America, there's going to be a suitcase nuclear bomb go off. I don't know if it's true or not. And neither does he, but he's contacted the people in Washington, D.C. and in other military installations he knows who have given him the code words that they're very concerned about it happening. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Robert Griswold of Ready Made Resources. We've just been talking about what he's gotten attending these international meetings, the last one in Singapore. I was simply commenting that our good friend Colonel Craig Roberts, who's, we carry a number of his books, Medusa File, A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza, it's called Kill Zone, the story of the assassination of President Kennedy. But Craig has been our guest on a number of occasions, done a number of exciting interviews with him, and Craig has recently told us on other programs, we'll be having him on this evening program hopefully very soon, that his contacts within the military and within the intelligence are very concerned that there actually are suitcase nuclear bombs in the United States, and they could be certainly detonated to bring terror to this country and to collapse our economy. And believe me, all it would take would be one or two nuclear bombs, and this whole house of cards that is our financial system could come tumbling down with terror in the hearts of the American people. And really, the American people have grown soft and complacent and comfortable. And, of course, in most instances, I think have turned away from God, looking to themselves, looking to government to take care of them. And I think that Bob Griswold's message, the message of Ready Made Resources, is that people are going to have to prepare to look after themselves. Would that be a fair statement, Bob?
Oh, exactly. Doctor, even if you give the government, if you believe what they say, that they're there and they're this Homeland Security thing that they're doing is there to help the average American, the cold hard facts, which I don't believe that. I mean, I don't think they really have the intention to. But even if they did, let's just say that they're going to do their best. they cannot get you what you need in time. Nuclear weapon, one of the first things the person needs to realize is that potassium iodate is something that protects our thyroid gland. It's a readily available pill at this time, where it protects thyroids, especially of young children, you know, where they're very susceptible to thyroid damage. The ability to get that out to everybody that would be in need of it, I think is highly unlikely. The distribution of it is just not going to happen. And we have to keep in mind that if you go back all the way to the 50s and 60s and look at when they detonated the bombs in the air, and then even Chernobyl and some of the nuclear power accidents they've had, that when this nuclear material goes high up into the atmosphere, it hits the jet stream and it just starts circling the planet. It can go around 7-8 times before it finally comes down. So really, a nuclear weapon that detonates anywhere in the world is a nuclear weapon that detonates everywhere in the world. And all you have to do is, again, the photos have been declassified, the air patterns of when they were doing all those testing. And really did it created an ecological havoc that we've never really been told about.
Now let me just point out to our listeners why potassium iodide is important. First of all, one of the byproducts of a nuclear explosion is radioactive iodine, and you inhale or ingest radioactive iodine, and it goes to your thyroid, and it gets in your thyroid, and because it's radioactive, it's concentrated there, and of course it'll destroy your thyroid, and you'll end up hypothyroid or athyroid. So what you do is you load your system up with potassium iodide, and so that the radioactive iodine, even if you take it in, is not going to be able to get into your thyroid, because there's lots of iodine already there. And that's the theory behind it, and that is of course why they have the potassium iodide readily available for our military. But nothing is being done to prepare the civilian population of this country, so they're going to protect the military but not the civilian population. We have to ask, why is that? We know that the militaries have bought up large supplies and has them available.
Well, you know, that's the fact, Doctor. It isn't something clarify something also, it's not something that cures you if you get radioactive iodine into your thyroid. It's something that prevents it. It's not a cure. Once it's in there, it's in there. This has to be taken immediately upon, you know, the release of a nuclear weapon. If you're in down range from it, you need to take this immediately so that you can saturate your thyroid before the radioactive iodine comes floating in.
How much do you actually take, Bob?
Well, it depends on, there's different sizes out there. The 85 milligram tablet, which is a standard tablet from the company we purchase it from, you could actually take up to 3 tabs a day, depending if you're a full grown adult. But children, you can even give it to your animals. Children, a baby, maybe a quarter of a tablet, 3 times a day. The protocol comes with each bottle so that you know how much you weigh. Again, you don't give the same amount to a child or a baby that you would to a full-grown adult.
So basically, it's something you would have on hand, and you'd just keep it there, and you wouldn't use it until you were aware that there was a nuclear attack. But then you wouldn't panic. You'd at least know that you were able to protect that aspect of your body. And then, of course, I know that Ready-Made Resources does. It can tell people how to get this product. And then, of course, you need to know what's happening from a radiation point of view. And what about Geiger counters? What's this nuke alert that the people talk about?
Well, a nuke alert actually is a little size. It's a small radiation meter, the size of a car door opener that you keep on your keychain. A lot of people complain about, you know, complicated gadgets and meters and switches and dials and, you know, but this thing is very simple to use. It has no meters, no dials. It just makes a chirping sound. And on the back, it tells you if it's chirping one time in a row, 2 times in a row, all the way up to 10 times in a row, how much radiation and how long you have before you receive a lethal dose at that rate. So it's really designed for everybody. Now, even though I know how to read some pretty complicated radiation meters, I can't carry one with me when I'm out driving around, when I'm in the supermarket or wherever. You can't carry one with you. But you can carry this on your keychain. And people don't even know what it is. But if it starts clicking, then you need to maybe figure out why it's starting to do this, because there's radiation in the area. Very easy to use, has a 10-year battery life on it. Same thing with the potassium iodate. It stores for 10 years. So it's not something you have to just keep rotating and buying new. This nuke alert has a 10-year battery in it. So it's something that'll keep you protected for a very long time for a little bit of cost, you know, because you spread it over 10 years, and it just becomes very economical to have one of these things. And that way, you know, keep in mind, this is the thing we have to keep in mind, that not only did the Soviets not tell people that they had a major accident at Chernobyl, which they didn't, and until the Western powers started picking up radiation coming somewhere, and then we figured out what was going on. The Soviets finally admitted it, but part of the damage had already been done. But even at Three Mile Island, you know, they tried to hush it up and were telling people everything's fine, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. And this is a lot of times what we can expect from government, because they don't want to panic people, and I can, you know, I mean, I don't want to panic anybody either, but I also want to tell them the truth if they're in harm's way. And these are the devices that keep, you know, kind of like the government honest, if you can ever imagine such a thing, that, you know, no, wait a second, you say there's no radiation, but I have a radiation meter, and it's saying something's wrong here.
Well, I think the important thing is that people realize that they really have to begin thinking about taking care of themselves. Now, you have a catalog, don't you, that where people can actually get at least a list of the things that are available that you've thought that would be important. And don't you actually, on your website, actually have you know, a book up there on how to protect yourself in case of a nuclear attack, the information that every family should have and have pulled out and stored away someplace, thinking about this possibility. We should hate to think of the unthinkable, but if we don't think about it now, it could be too late. So why don't you tell them about your website, and then what's that book that you have up there on your website?
Okay, well, our website is Ready Made Resources, and that's all one word, standard spelling, readymaderesources.com. And if they go, when they go to the website, you, on the left-hand side, there's all the products that they can look at. And if they're looking for this type of product, at the very bottom, it has WMD protection. You can go there. But across the top right, it says important information links. And there's quite a few books there that are free for downloading. One of them is a military manual on dealing with medical issues concerning, you know, radiological, chemical, biological poisoning. And that's a very thorough manual that you can download for free. There's also Creasing Carey. Now, Creasing Carey is a PhD who really was one of the founders of our civil defense program, pushed it hard, taught people how they could survive, even on some very modest budgets, a nuclear explosion, because he realized that people are the strength of a nation, and the more people that survive, the better we off are off as a people. So he made a book, Nuclear War Survival Skills. Now, if you buy the book, and you would, you know, it's normally about $20-$25, but you can go to the website and download the whole file for free. And so in Creasing Carey's book, you can get and read how you can protect your family. It you know, Doctor, it truly amazes me, these people who say they're there to protect us and that they will help us in the event of an emergency. Why aren't they telling us what to do now? They're telling us that a nuclear weapon is going to go off in this country. La-di-da-di-da-di-da. Trust us when it happens. Why aren't they telling us what to do now?
Well, then you're supposed to get duct tape and plastic. That's how it is. I mean, the things that you need to get, and don't you actually have lists of what people should be setting aside now in case of an emergency?
Right, and it's more than duct tape and plastic. You know, and again, if people who have basements, it's very easy to protect yourself from nuclear fallout. But again, it's one of the things that points out, a chemical attack, you don't want to go in your basement. You want to go up in your attic as high as you can get off the ground, because chemicals are made to hover around the ground level. And if you have an opening, it'll fall down in your basement. Whereas nuclear, you want to get in your basement. So these are things people need to know. This is the things the government should really be telling people.
And
you know,
where to get water supply.
Yeah, how to purify water.
And all of these things are so important. And it doesn't do any harm to start thinking about it, to have things set aside so that if there were a cataclysmic event, you would not panic. And our plea to people is at least take this into consideration as a possibility. You're not going to be able to go off and have a hideaway. Believe me, they have underground bunkers for the elite in this country. They have them all over Washington, D.C. They have them in California, up them at Santa Rosa. But those are only for the elite. The rest of us are going to have to fend for ourselves, and we put the programs on from time to time with the idea that perhaps you will begin thinking along this line and begin to make preparations. What's your telephone number there, Bob? That
people they can call after the program, because I'll be the only one here to answer it. But it's 800-627-3809. Again, it's 800-627-3809. Again, we have that catalog that's available if people call after the program.
And, of course, the thing is that it's a little late back there because, of course, Bob, it's after midnight. But, of course, they'll be there.
I'll be here for about a half an hour after the program.
Okay, fine. Or Bob's wife will be there. So, all right, we'll be right back in just a moment. Well, Bob, of course, as you talk to people, are people making preparations for the unthinkable?
Well, you know, we've actually had a real pickup in the amount of people interested in the potassium iodate. And again, one of the major suppliers for potassium iodate has now stopped making it. So we have one supplier left that we know of that's really making it for civilian purchase.
So what are they making it? You know, is the military still buying this up?
Well, I'm sure they are. I'm sure the military is still buying it. The problem is that potassium iodate is something you need to have on hand. It's not something you can buy after the event. And besides that, the last time there was a nuclear scare in the country, you know, people get very greedy, and I'm not saying we do, but I'm just saying, you know, it doubled, tripled, quadrupled in price, and people were willing to pay it, because man's worst nature comes out sometimes in those circumstances. The thing to do is to get it now, because, again, the other problem was the last time that people thought there might have been some kind of nuclear problem is that you couldn't get it. Everybody bought up every bit of the supply. The government went out and bought just cases and cases and cases of it, and there was none to be had. So it's just a choice people have to make. You can prepare now, or you can just really kind of wing it when it happens. And there's nothing that will protect your thyroid other than the potassium iodate. I've heard people say, well, I can take iodized salt. You can't eat enough salt to do that. That's not a very good thought, because I talked to the doctors and they're doing this. There's not enough iodine in the salt to saturate your thyroid. You really need a product like potassium iodate.
And of course, doesn't the military actually have that for their personnel? Because they certainly have studied this. They understand what you have to do, and you have to protect yourself in all sorts of ways. But this is one of the accepted ways, because there's nothing, of course, worse than getting your thyroid laden with the radioactive iodine and simply get wiped out, and then your life is never the same after that.
Well, it isn't. And again, there's other aspects of radiation that we need to be concerned about, and that does take the meter. Somebody might even be considering a protective mask. Things like all those things are unfortunate side effects of or things that we might have to address in this day which we live. And it's unfortunate, but I'm just an average thinking person, but from what I hear, what I read, I just think this is a very viable scenario, and I know I have a wife and children, and I really want to be the one to protect those, and I want them to live. And so as that, I do prepare. I mean, I'm not just telling people to do this. I do have my potassium iodate and protective mask and different things that are necessary.
And you need water storage, you need food storage, you need electricity if you have a means of producing a little electricity through a solar panel. All of these things are things that you need. You need the medical supplies on hand. You need to have your vitamins and minerals, a good supply of these, to keep up your immune system. And you need to know what to have on hand, and you need to think about it now. And, of course, we have programs dealing with health, dealing with that aspect of it. But right now we're talking about the general preparation, the things that you should start looking up for. And, actually, you have a list of them up on your website, don't you?
Yeah, and not all of them will apply to everybody. But, I mean, if you wear glasses, you might want to make sure you have extra pair of glasses. If you have prescription medicine that you need, you might want to think about having a little bit of that aside. You know, another thing people have a misunderstanding about radiation, doctor, is the fact that, people don't become radioactive. Water does not become radioactive.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment with Bob Griswold. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bob was just commenting that people have a lot of misconceptions about what would happen in the case of a nuclear attack. And, of course, the question is, does water become radioactive? Do you have to worry about your water if there is some sort of a nuclear attack? You have to have water. You can't survive without it. You can survive a certain period of time without food, but not without water. So what's the answer to that question, Bob?
Well, nothing. To become radioactive, it has to be a certain molecular weight, and there's different things that affect it. But water does not become radioactive. In fact, water is a very good shield against radiation. Now, with that said, keep in mind that when you have billions of radioactive particles in the air, they all come down, and they do get in the water. That's what becomes radioactive. You have water that has radioactive particles in it. Things like a big Berkey water filters, those will take those particles out. So you have to be careful doing it because you're still dealing with water that has radioactive particles in it. But hypothetically, let's just say, doctor, you had a can of ravioli, and it was right next to a nuclear weapon that went off. And this is an amazing can because it does not get destroyed when the nuclear weapon goes off. And the can's intact. You find the can. You open it up. The food inside is not radioactive. Now, if there's radioactive dust on the top of the can, and you open the lid and the radioactive dust gets in the can, yes, then the food, you ingest radioactivity, and that's not a good thing to do. So those kind of things are misnomers. Irradiated food does not have radioactivity in it. It can destroy the food value of the food, but it does not have radiation in it.
Well, I think one of the things that I've learned looking into this, and I think that you can correct me, but the thing is that ordinarily the filters, and they're Berkey filters, and there are other filters, but certainly the Berkeys are pretty much standard, either the big Berkey or the Berkey light, will filter out these radioactive particles. The problem is that after a certain period of time, the filters themselves get clogged up with the radiation, so you need an extra set of the filters to have on hand, either the big Berkey or the Berkey light, so that, once those filters become contaminated after a week or 2 weeks, that you would be able, of course, to replace them with the big Berkey filters where you can boil them, but with the Berkey lights, you're going to have replacements on hand. The things to think about now, when, of course, we have plenty of time to think, and we have ready access to getting everything we really would like to. Now, let me just once again suggest, if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to give us a call. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And if you'd like to, I get Bob's telephone number and you're interested in the catalog. Bob, why don't you give that telephone number out just one more time and
again,
the website.
Just want to caution people, call after the program because I'm the only one here at this time. It's 12:30 here on the East Coast. But they can call me at 800-627-3809. 800-627-3809. Or again, I do encourage them to go visit the website because of the information they can get on it, and that's readymaderesources.com. All one word, readymaderesources.com. Go to the important information links on the top right-hand side of the page, and you can download, again, First Aid for Soldiers, which carries a lot of information on dealing with nuclear, chemical, and biological fatalities and casualties. And also, you can download Increasing Carries Nuclear War Survival Skills for free.
Well, actually, I knew him. He attended the Doctors for Defense Preparedness, and of course, he died just a couple of years ago. A very courageous man who dedicated his whole life to warning people to become prepared. And let's hope and pray that nothing like this ever happens. But I fear that if God is just, His justice will not sleep forever. So our plea to you is begin at least thinking, get a list of the things you need to have on hand, and none of them are terribly difficult or terribly expensive. A few of them might be, but the general things that you need are the things that you would need simply to survive in your own home. You're not going to be able to go racing off into the mountains or the hills. The average person is not going to. So you're going to have to figure out how you're going to be able to look after yourself where you are. And there's certain things that Bob talks about, he lists there in his catalog, and then, of course, they're all listed up there on the website. I think you'll find it a fascinating place, and that is readymaderesources.com. Is that it?
Yes, that is readymaderesources.com. And again, I think you mentioned if people have any questions now about this subject, they can call in, and we can try to do our best to help answer them. And get some information out there to people who have questions.
All right, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. We'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Bob Griswold, and certainly we're talking about the matter of preparedness. And, you know, what do you really need to do to prepare? And, you know, there are a lot of people out there who don't have a lot of money, but there are certain things that you can get, and the things that you might not even think about. You need a sewing kit. Certainly you need to think about how you're going to be able to have water, and you can store water at the present time, and there are books that will tell you how to store water, and you can get containers, large containers. Water will last for a good long while. If it's properly treated, you probably want to put a little bit of chlorine, just plain old Clorox in it, and of course it will tend to sterilize it, so it will really last literally for years. So these things have been done for a long period of time. You need to begin thinking about having water on hand. You need to have food on hand. You need to have medical supplies on hand. And you need to think about how you're going to look after your own family, and then hopefully you'd be in a position to help others as well. So we have a couple of people calling in, and I'll just ask that let's go ahead and pull one of these down while the first one's getting screened. Hi, who do we have on the line?
Hi, this is Jack.
Hi, Jack. Do you have a question?
Yeah. Two, actually. I heard some interview before Y2K, and this was a preparedness person recommending a very inexpensive way to store food, say in metal garbage cans. Metal garbage cans, and I'd like to know if Bob knows anything about that. And
what sort of food is this you're talking about? Is this canned food? Is this prepared food? Is this bulk food?
Right.
Is this wheat? What is it?
Oh, Dr. Stan, you're right. Like the bulk trail mixes, stuff like that. Maybe dried beans.
Okay, I could tell you right now that's not a good idea, and I'll tell you why. Because as soon as you put a lid on top of the garbage can, especially a metal can, You have a temperature differential from the inside to the outside of the can, you're going to create condensation inside the can.
I see.
Unless you can get all the air outside the can or have extremely dry air inside the can, as soon as that temperature differential hits, if you have a cold day and there's, the temperature outside is going to change quicker than the temperature inside the garbage can, humidity is going to form inside the can. If all you have to do is just, do the experiment. Put a garbage can outside on a cold day. You know, it's warm outside, and as it turns cool, you'll find moisture forming inside and on the outside of the can. So it's really not a good idea to do it that way. You will have a lot of food ruined real quick.
Okay.
And there are certainly plastic buckets that you can get.
Plastic buckets.
One of the things, if you're going to see, you can even can goods, but you have to put something in there to take out the oxygen. We'll be back here in just a moment. And, of course, we were just talking about food shortage. I mean, I think probably you're better off to get something ready prepared. I know before Y2K, we went to a Mormon cannery, and it was really fascinating to see how they instruct their people to make their preparations. And certainly they have the food, they have the cans, but you always put an oxygen pack in there to absorb all the oxygen in that can before you put the lid on. So there are people who've thought a lot about this, but I know that you can certainly, why don't you, if you're interested in food shortage, I'd suggest you give Bob a call off the air, and he can tell you a lot more, okay?
Jack, I'm sorry, Dr. Stan, one real quick last question. Bob, you mentioned solar power in the EU. I saw a documentary, and they featured European Space Agency using some, I guess, proprietary solar panels they developed for deep space probes, and they said we don't have to use plutonium; we can use the good old solar power. And I was wondering if Bob knew anything about those really advanced solar panels.
The solar panels, like even on the space station, they're far more efficient. The problem right now is because the technology is sort of sequestered because they don't want you becoming solar independent because of all the billions they spent on power plants. They want to keep people paying for those things. The ability to produce a higher efficiency solar panel is out there. It's just that when you're not making very many of them, the price is prohibitive in cost. Even today, a 180, 190 watt solar panel, you could spend the best part of $1,000 on it, $700, $800. So The technology's out there, just that they're not being made in a high demand, and because of that, the price becomes prohibitive. As far as the other thing, you know, the farther you get away from the sun, the less the solar panels are going to work, and I think that's when they use the plutonium and the reactors, is when they go deep space probes, where the sun's ability to hit a solar panel becomes very marginal, and that way you need another source of power. But yes, you can produce a higher and better solar panel just right now, because the oil companies are so involved with solar energy, and they are kind of quenching the technology a little bit.
Okay, anything else, Jack?
No, thank you so much, Dr.
God bless, and again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Bob Griswold, Bob, I'm going to let you give your telephone number one more time, and then your website, and then we'll probably let you go.
Okay, they can call me at 800-627-3809, and the website is readymaderesources.com.
All right, fine. Well, God bless you, and thanks so much. We'll look forward to talking to you again next month.
Thank you, Neil.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Bob Griswold, Ready Made Resources, so we're going to do open lines the rest of this hour, and if you're out there, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And let me just talk a little bit about, as I see, the whole issue unfolding in the Middle East. But perhaps before we even discuss what's going on in Iraq today, we have to go into the background of what happened in Vietnam. Because if you don't understand Vietnam, you really can't understand Iraq. You go into what happened in Vietnam. We had millions and millions of American soldiers who rotated in and out of that country. Now, the South Vietnamese could have handled the situation on their own, only the CIA assassinated Mr. Diem and Mr. Nguyen. And if you doubt that, a book written by the brother of the head of the mafia, Chuck Giancana's book, The Double Cross, the Church Committee hearings, the United States CIA destabilized the country there by killing off the two leaders, Mr. Diem and Mr. Nguyen. So now America is drawn into the war. But how do you keep the war going? America, a mighty military machine with certainly superior naval power and air power, and the people on the ground, a very effective military organization. So you don't let them win the war. I mean, well, and we have, if any of you are interested in it, we have the Gulf of Tonkin papers. Actually, they were congressional record remarks by Barry Goldwater, going into the rules of engagement. We call them the Gulf of Tonkin documents, but it really has to do with the rules of engagement. Do you realize that when our planes were flying up in North Vietnam, and there was an airfield, a North Vietnamese military airfield, and they had MiG fighter planes there, of the kind that were killing our boys and were being used against our troops and shooting down our planes, but we couldn't fire on those MiG planes as long as they were on the ground. They were given safe sanctuary there. The only way we could fire at a MiG airplane was if it was actually in the air shooting at one of our planes, then it was all right to shoot back. We were not allowed to bomb the hydroelectric plants in North Vietnam. Had we bombed the hydroelectric plants, we would have cut off all the electricity to North Vietnam. Their whole society would have collapsed, and that would have ended the war. But that was not the goal. We did not want to end the war, because we ended the war. How could we justify keeping our troops there? We were not allowed to bomb the major rail lines coming out of Haiphong. And, of course, it was over those rail lines that the supplies were being sent to the North Vietnamese troops to be taken down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to be used to kill our boys. Of course, a lot of trucks were coming out of Haiphong. They were being unloaded in Haiphong off of Soviet freighters, and we weren't allowed to stop the Soviet freighters. Why? Because those trucks were being built in the Kama River plant, which had been financed in Russia by the United States government. They were being built at the Ford Motor Plant at Gorky in the Soviet Union, a plant that had been built by Henry Ford and updated by the Ford Motor Company, so that when those trucks were going down the Ho Chi Minh Trail over in Laos and in Cambodia, why, they looked like American trucks, and they were American trucks. They were built in an American factory in the Soviet Union, but the American people were never allowed to know. that we gave massive amounts and let massive amounts of money to the Soviets all during the Vietnam War so we could keep the war going. And I personally talked to William H. Sullivan, who was the American ambassador to South Vietnam during the war. And he personally told me, and I interviewed him at the Columbia Assembly, or the American Assembly at Columbia University, I believe it was in 1980. And William H. Sullivan told me, you know, I never understood why we did not end the war. I mean, I'm not a military man. I'm a diplomat. But I could have won the war in 2 months if they'd let me. All we had to do was attack North Vietnam. But we weren't allowed to do that. General Lewis Wald, a four-star Marine general, told me exactly the same thing. And I've talked to so many people. We could have won the war at any time. We were never allowed to. We'd send our men into an area and clear it out of the Viet Cong and then pull our men back again. We were never allowed to hit the major targets. And our men were pulled back time after time after time. Our soldiers won the war over there. If you read the newspaper reports about the Tet Offensive, we were told it was a great defeat for America. It really wasn't. I mean, they killed tens of thousands of North Vietnamese. I mean, 2 million North Vietnamese died during the war. 1 million South Vietnamese. We never talk about the Vietnamese who died in the war. Yes, we lost 58,000 Americans, and I weep when I think of those courageous American boys going over there to fight in a war we never intended to win. It was totally a diversion. And how can I say that? Why, very simply because the people who got us in the war said that. People like McGeorge Bundy. Skull and Bones, in an article in January 1967 issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, which of course is written for the elite who rule our country. And McGeorge Bundy, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, member of Skull and Bones, good close personal friend of Henry Stimson, who was Secretary of War during the Second World War and got us into that foolish and very, very unnecessary war, because we financed the Germans both before and during the war. If you haven't read the book Trading with the Enemy, or Charles Ingham's book, or Professor Sutton's book Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, or the letter I have from Ambassador the American ambassador to Germany back in 1936, writing to Colonel Howe, Ambassador Dodd is writing and saying, why are American corporations building up Hitler's war machine? We've got 100 American corporations here, and they can't even get the money out of the country. Why are they building it up? Well, it's the same thing over in China today. American corporations are going over there. And they can't get any money out. They can get goods out, but they can't get any money out because of the exchange restrictions. Why are American corporations build up Hitler's Germany before and trade with him during the Second World War? Why are American corporations building up in communist China today the best enemy that money could buy? Well, when you understand that we kept that war going on for 10 years as a diversion, and if you want the verification, the article is January 1967 in Foreign Affairs magazine, written by McGeorge Bundy, chairman of the National Security Advisor to both President Kennedy and President Johnson, the man who got us into the war. And he tells you quite openly, if you read the last two pages of his article, the end of Either Or, that we were there to change America. And if we stopped the war, there'd be tremendous reaction against their socialist programs. He called them the Great New Departures in Health and Education and Welfare, but he was really talking about their socialist programs here in the United States. The elite wanted to bring socialism, and you needed a distraction. Vietnam was a wonderful distraction. And Iraq today is a wonderful distraction. Of course, we do intend to keep our troops there permanently. We are never going to bring all of our troops home. Let's go to Joe, who's calling from New York. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. What part of New York are you calling from?
Long Island.
Okay, fine. Are you listening shortwave or internet?
Shortwave sometimes.
Okay, fine. Do you have a question or comment?
Question and a comment. Question is, I don't know about out of New York, but as far as I know, in New York, they stopped the air raid drills in schools.
Right.
Why would they do that for?
Very, very good. Go ahead.
Yeah, why would they do that for?
Well, because we stopped all civil defense in the United States. We stopped making any preparations to defend the American people. We adopted a policy back in the late 1960s of mutual destruction.
I know, but that's where the fallout shelters are for nuclear...
That's right. No. But you see, they don't intend to defend the American people.
I know.
All right, fine. That's a simple answer.
Yeah. Also, the latest threat, the video from Al-Qaeda, I think he's bluffing and he's going for another country.
I'm sorry, what was the point you're making, Joe?
The new video from threat from Al-Qaeda.
Right, what about it?
I think he's bluffing and he's going for another country from what he's saying.
Well, we don't even know if Osama bin Laden is putting these out. They may be being created in Langley, Virginia, at the CIA headquarters. And I will tell you that the message that Osama bin Laden put out just before the election last November, I don't think Osama bin Laden put that. And the reason I don't think it put it out is, number one, it was almost like a program to get George Bush reelected. Oh, we're going to threaten you. But Osama bin Laden in that message said, you know, you've lost so many troops and 17,000 Iraqi civilians have been lost. Now, the figure at that time being accepted throughout the world was 100,000 Iraqi civilians. The CIA was saying 17,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed. Why would Osama bin Laden use the CIA's figures rather than the figures that were accepted throughout the world?
The problem in the United States with people accepting money to work against the wrong people, and also, you know, there's always been secret stealing, you know, secret selling and all that. Crazy too.
Well, we live in a world gone mad, Joe, and I don't think we have to evaluate everything we see, and I'm suspicious of everything I see and read.
Right.
Hey, God bless
you.
We've got another caller. Do you have anything else?
Okay. Excellent.
Good night.
Say hello to Arnold for me.
Arnold and I aren't on a first name basis.
All right.
But let's go to Jim calling from Missouri. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you, Doctor?
I'm doing fine.
You used a quote a day or two ago on the radio. A man wrote an article, maybe in Foreign Affairs, I don't recall, but it was in 1974 talking about having to circumvent our Constitution to do away.
His term was, we'll do an end run around
end
the
run.
Constitution.
Yes, sir.
And that was April 1974 in Foreign Affairs magazine, and the author was a man named Richard Gardner. A Rhodes Scholar, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he was appointed ambassador to Spain under Bill Clinton. But he basically said, you know, we want to get a world government, and we're not going to be able to get it. Because of course the constitutions, we're going to have to do an end run around the Constitution, and we're going to have to use things like the World Trade Organization and GATT, which is the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, and then we're going to have to use the Law of the Sea Treaty, and by international treaties, we will circumvent the Constitution, because you see, these traitors, and they are traitors, hate America, and they are dedicated to establishing a world government under the control of a ruling aristocracy. And that was really what he said, April 1974, Foreign Affairs magazine.
Have you included that quote in any of your newsletters?
I don't think I have, but if you want, you can give us a call and ask for it. We'll send you a copy of it. We have the magazine, and we'll send you the pages out of it where you can read it. And but there's so many great quotes out there, I just can't include them all in my newsletter.
May I ask you something else?
Sure, you can.
Well, I read this weekend about President Bush's results from his physical examination.
Right,
and they happened to note that he takes dietary supplements.
Right.
Now, do you think, I believe no matter what this codex does, I think we both know that he'll continue to get his dietary supplements.
And he will, of course, he will not be going to an HMO like the guy wants you to have to do, right?
But I heard your recollection about the time that you met him, and I honestly don't know if he's just in so far over his head, or if he knows exactly what he's doing, as you would put it.
I think that he is simply a figurehead for the power elite who are behind him, for the ruling oligarchy or the oligarchy, the ruling hierarchy. So he has certainly the people who control him: Karl Rove, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney. And he is simply their man. He was picked by the establishment. Apparently George Shultz had an interview with him, and George Shultz then reported to the powers that be that he looked like he'd be all right. So he was selected to become the president, and they ran him for president. And he always got good press, and he seemed like such a nice, folksy fellow. I will have to tell you that George W. Bush is not really very smart. And I don't mean to demean him, but that's the truth of the matter. And when the man sitting next to me in this meeting, when we were here with him, there were only about perhaps 15 of us, 16. And the man sitting next to me asked the man, George W. Bush, the governor of Texas at that time, if indeed there was a, you were president and somebody of the Congress passed legislation that was unconstitutional, would you sign it? And George Bush sat there. He sat there and he said, "I don't understand the question." And so, now this is true. And he said then, "Well, let me simplify it. And if it was on education, it was unconstitutional, would you sign it?" He said, "I'll have to look into it. We'll be back in just a moment." Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is, our guest is gone, but right now we've got Jim still on the line from Missouri. I believe that George Bush, I don't know what's in his heart, but I do know that that he reads his speeches. They give him a script when he does his his press conferences. It's all scripted. As we often say, reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. And I'm much more worried about Dick Cheney and I am Donald Rumsfeld and Karl Rove than I am about George Bush. So anything else you'd like to say or ask?
No, sir, but I appreciate your show, and I mostly wanted to hear you say, would you repeat the man's name again?
Richard Gardner?
Richard Gardner.
All right, fine. If you need to get the article, you can always give us a call. We'll get it for you. Or if you have a local library, Foreign Affairs, April of 1974.
I think they probably keep a track on who checks those things out, though.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Let's go to James is calling from Texas. Hi, James. How are you doing?
Oh, fine, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. What part of Texas are you in?
I'm down southeast, close to Houston.
How are you hearing us?
Well, come in good. A couple of different stations to come in on, and I'll listen to you when I get the chance. I just started listening to shortwave about a couple of months ago, but I've listened to you before on that Southwest Radio Church with
Noah Hutchins.
Mr. Hutchins.
Yeah, he's a Brother Hutchins. He's a great guy.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any questions you'd like to ask?
Well, an opinion, I think. I've been studying, an unrelated subject, but it came up, and that was about Kennedy being elected, and that the Catholic hierarchy is the one that got him elected, because his dad, Joe Kennedy, thanked him. You know, profusely for getting his son elected.
But how do you know that? Where did you get
that? There's a book out on it. I read a review on it in the Houston Chronicle. I don't even know the name of the book, but I cut the article out. I still have the article.
Well, why don't you make a copy of that? Because I really think it was the mafia that got Jack Kennedy elected. Joe went to the mafia in Chicago and one other state, and they're the ones, of course, who stole the votes to put him in office.
Well, this guy was close to the Kennedys, and he was a staunch Roman Catholic. A lot of people think he was just a nominal Catholic, but he was a staunch Roman Catholic.
Don't you just simply cut the article out? I'd love to see it. You can send it to my post office box 13 in Santa Cruz. Hey, we're out of time, but
okay.
Thanks very much for calling.
Hey.
Good night.
Listen.
I got to go.
Hey,
we're out of time.
He started the Vietnam War. He was a payback.
Okay, thanks so much. Good night. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. We'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up tonight's program.
Payback.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when we've got Jack on the line from Michigan, but Jack, we're out of time, so we'll have to talk to you sometime later. But right now, of course, we want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And we hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we are able to do what we do and gradually to expand our coverage. And we hope very soon we're going to be able to pick up an additional 18 stations in the Middle West for at least 1 hour on this evening program. So if you would like to help us, if you're in a position to help, it's going to be a moderately expensive proposition and undertaking. On the other hand, it's something that we can do, and if enough of you will pitch in, why, we'll be taking on those additional 18 stations. So if you'd like to help us, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And what I can do, I can have the time to, do 5 hours of talk radio a day, but it's up to you to help us expand our listening audience. And if you can't help, you can certainly tell others about our program. You can encourage them to listen. You can encourage them to become educated and begin to understand what's really going on in the world. Now, we just had a caller from Texas who feels that the Catholics are the big problem. Well, I will tell you there are other people who believe that the Jesuits are the big problem. And there are other people who tell me that the Jews are the big problem. And there are other people who tell me that it's all the Skull and Bone Society or all the Bilderbergers. And within each one of those groups, there are dark and sinister spirits of forces, although I think that most Catholics are good people and many of them love the Lord. I believe that there are many wonderful Jewish people. But within all the hierarchy groups, and specifically within all the secret societies, there are satanic forces that are intent upon bringing about a one-world government and a one-world religion. So don't get simply taken off onto one group and spend all your time hating that group, because what they're trying to do is divide us and turn American against American, because that's how they're going to defeat us. And there's so much information up there on the Internet and so many books that are out there and even radio programs that are taking away from an understanding of what's really going on. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. We hope many of you will go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And, of course, look at the material that we have there. We could suggest something like my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which would give you tremendous insight into how this fits together. If you'd like a free copy of my June newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, and, of course, you can get The Occult Hierarchy Part 1 on my website and 2 at the website at www.radioliberty.com, www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs 5 hours a day on the Internet, now 3 hours a day on Radio Liberty, soon to be 4 hours a day on Radio Liberty, and then links to the other Internet sites where you can actually get our program. We are on satellite. If you have satellite, we have shortwave, 4 hours a day, and all those references are up on the Internet at radioliberty.com. But if you'd like a free copy of our June newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927.